You're listening to the Academy Securities Geopolitical and Macro Strategy Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Robinson, and today's episode was recorded on March 11th, 2024. Brett Lowry is the moderator for this podcast episode. He helps facilitate a conversation where our experts discuss the global risk landscape around the world.
Welcome to our latest Academy Securities Geopolitical and Macro Strategy Podcast. I'm your moderator, Brett Lowry, head of special situations here at Academy Securities. Before we kick off, a quick word from our sponsor. This podcast is brought to you by the Academy Vets ETF, a veteran impact ETF focused on providing market-based returns while investing in mortgage-backed and asset-backed securities that support veterans. Vets with a Z invests in residential mortgage loans to active duty service members and veterans, as well as loans to veteran-owned small businesses. To learn more, please visit academyetfs.com or contact your broker. Academy Vets ETF is offered by Academy Asset Management, the asset management affiliate of Academy Securities, a registered broker-dealer. Today, I'm joined by General Robert Walsh and Maria Donnelly from our Geopolitical Intelligence Group and Peter Chur, our head of macro strategy here at Academy Securities. On this podcast, we're going to cover a lot of ground today as we go around the world. We will kick off with an update on the war in Gaza as ceasefire talks have stalled and Israel prepares for a ground operation into Rafah. Meanwhile, a U.S. ship just left Virginia and is en route to the Middle East to build a pier to offload emergency supplies in Gaza to address the humanitarian situation on the ground. We will also address the situation in the Red Sea, where Houthi rebels conducted a lethal attack against a commercial vessel last week, and their activity has increased in the past few weeks, despite U.S. coalition strikes. We'll also address the latest developments in the war in Ukraine as Ukraine struggles with falling supplies and ammunition, and Russia has gained momentum with recent victories in the east. We'll also report on the tension in the South China Sea following an incident where Chinese Coast Guard ships sideswiped a Philippine patrol vessel last week near the Second Thomas Shoal. And finally, we will provide an update on Haiti and the unrest where the U.S. has begun to evacuate non-essential personnel and has reinforced security at the embassy there. I will kick it over now to General Walsh to start the presentation off with an update on the war in Gaza. General Walsh.
Yeah, thanks, Brett. Great to be with you today. You know, I think the key piece here is what we're starting to see is the division between the Biden administration and what we're seeing from the Netanyahu administration on the ceasefire and where that seems to be going. You know, there was a lot of talks in the last couple of weeks about a ceasefire. The demands that Hamas really put forward were very unrealistic for the Israelis to, you know, the ceasefire would be to end the conflict is really what they were asking for in the Israeli IDF forces to leave Gaza. And that was just obviously a no-go situation for the Israelis to go through all that they've gone through to pick up and leave and expect Hamas to rebuild and then continue their attacks. So those negotiations, I didn't think really got anywhere really serious towards ending the conflict. And when it comes to conflict negotiations, it always comes down to both sides have to be to the point where they're willing to negotiate. And in this case, the negotiations didn't go really anywhere. So where does that let it lay right now? What we see really is it's back into Israel's hands. And what we see is there's a tactical situation on the ground, the military situation that Israel is having to deal with and the Israeli Defense Forces. They've got a plan, and their plan was all along to go in there and defeat and destroy Hamas. You know, the U.S. plan and the international plan is try to get to a ceasefire, get humanitarian aid in there. But on the Israeli side is they're also looking for the international community to come up with a long-term strategy. And what is the long-term strategy from the international community? And the Israelis have kind of said, hey, we're dealing with the military operations. We'll let the international community, hopefully led by the U.S., deal with the long-term plan. And they haven't come up with a plan yet. So without a plan, without a ceasefire, the military operations are going to continue. And in a lot of ways, the IDF has been very successful in their military operations. And if anything, I would say the heavy-handedness approach that they've taken towards Hamas and within Palestine, within Gaza itself, with even with the death and destruction that's gone on there, it's sent a signal to others in the region, Iran, Hezbollah, that they're serious about what they're doing. So I think their heavy-handed approach has really shown that the Israelis have got the power and the will to go in there and rout Hamas in civilian locations. And they're in a lot of ways saying, don't mess with us because you can expect the same from us if you attack us. So I think in a lot of ways, the Netanyahu government and the IDF are continuing into the southern part because they know they have not eradicated all Hamas, and they're going to have to go into Rafah to do that. They signaled very clearly that they're going in there to both Hamas and the international community. And that's where I think we're starting to see some of the divisions between the Biden administration of not wanting them to go in there, the ceasefire to occur now, where I think the opportunity of no ceasefire agreement is really just really allowing the IDF to continue on its push to clear and destroy Hamas.
No, thank you, sir. Turn to Maria as well. I mean, obviously, it's, especially as we get into Ramadan and over the next few weeks, you know, Israel's job is clearly not finished. Netanyahu is not going to basically say we've declared victory after achieving 80% of our goal. They want to achieve as close to 100% as possible, obviously, as difficult as that may be, because obviously eradicating an ideology is likely impossible. But rolling back and destroying military capabilities and threat to Israel, you know, is an achievable goal in the near to medium term. But Maria, I'll pass over to you with respect to what we think the next few weeks looks like if we do or we don't reach a ceasefire, but with the overarching theme of how much do you think Israel has to accomplish in the next 4 to 6 weeks, at least to accomplish as much of their goal as possible, so then we can start getting into more of a reconstruction dialogue and what the, you know, effectively what Gaza is going to look like going forward from there.
Well, I think we've actually, thanks, Brett. We discussed this a couple months back, which is that Israel is operating on a timeline that the more and more pressure grows internationally, and more pressure grows politically in the U.S., and more there's their allies and partners are going to put pressure on them. That's going to be what defines their timeline. But I think that, like General Walsh said, the Netanyahu government has very clearly demonstrated that they kind of don't care. They're going to keep going after their objectives. And I think that it's unquestionable that they're going to go into Rafah. I would be very surprised if they didn't. I think that what they're doing right now is they're trying to hold off any other potential fronts. They're kind of not saber rattling, but they're really kind of reinforcing that border with Lebanon. And I think that they're going to go into Rafah because, again, now that there's starting to be international talk again of a two-state solution, now that you're getting pressure from the United States, you have this kind of aid peer, you have everything that President Biden talked about in his State of the Union, talking about kind of the fact that we need a ceasefire, talking about Gaza was one of the, I think he mentioned it 4 or 5 times in the State of the Union. I think that as we see all of that pressure building, they have to go into Rafah and they have to do it quickly in order to achieve those military goals. I think that they're going to face continued pressure as we go into Ramadan. And I think that it's the international community is going to continue to get more and more impatient with Israel. But I think that they're demonstrating that they have kind of they have the will, whether or not political, military, they're going to do it. And I agree. It's definitely sent a message to their neighbors that regardless of what the international community says, regardless of what the United States says, they are going to pursue the goals that the government has set out. For better or worse. Again, we don't know how effective this will be. We don't know if they can actually root out Hamas. But I do think that in terms of negotiating power, it does put them in a slightly different position if they can go into Rafah and they can make significant military, have significant military victories there.
Well, thank you, Maria. And you touched on the aid pier as well, which I think is another important point, which is a piece of news last week where the United States announced they will be building a pier in Gaza to facilitate the delivery of aid to the Palestinians. They've obviously been airdropping goods and food from the air over the last couple of weeks. But from a volume standpoint, that's obviously not nearly enough. And having a pier in place to offload goods directly is absolutely going to be somewhat helpful to the security, to the overall humanitarian situation in Gaza. But General Walsh, as we think about what the potential risks are there, obviously, huge benefit for the Palestinians, 100%, and we will move forward with that plan. But what are the risks to the United States once that pier is built? It will take still a few weeks to build. This is not going to be a this week event. But as the logistics campaign gets going and this likely the war in Gaza continues for the next several months, even if there's a ceasefire at some point, This situation will not be over likely for several more months. What are the potential risks to the United States with the peer? And obviously, what's the potential benefit as well?
Yeah, Brett, this is a very delicate situation, I think, for the Biden administration as they go in there. They've got, international community pressure on the U.S. to cease its support for Israel in Gaza and reduce the weapons flow into there and put, political diplomatic pressure on them to cease fire. The Biden administration also has from its own base has pressure to get to a ceasefire and stop the war. And there's a lot of people thinks that President Biden can put his finger on Israelis and press the button and get them to stop. Easier said than done. And as Israel's been an ally or friend and from the U.S. for many, many years, we supported them since after World War II. The President Biden's been very strong throughout his career and throughout this. But now he's having to deal with his own political base and international pressure also. So this is one where I think they're trying to thread the needle a little bit to show that they can do more to try to support the humanitarian effort for the Palestinian people by doing this peer effort. And you mentioned the risk here. And when military operations commence, we always look at risk to mission and risk to force. And if you look at the mission's not a hard mission to do. I mean, they've got it laid out. We do these type of missions all over the globe, certainly humanitarian assistance. We see typhoons and hurricanes. And this is something the U.S. military knows how to do along in combat operations to be able to build, go in and resupply rapidly with these type of mobile piers. We do it at sea also. So I think the mission is one that's very easy for the U.S. to do. The question here is you do it, though, you're doing it into a combat area. And so I think the risk to force here is, obviously, my expectations would be that they would go into an area that the Israelis would obviously be supporting this. They'd go into an area that's where the IDF has control of. They're probably going to go more into the northern part where Israel's got control or the central part. They're not going to go into the middle of the conflict where the IDF and an agreement with the IDF that they're going to provide security on land. Because one of the key things the president has said over the weekend was we would not have boots on the ground and not put that at risk and how that could maybe turn the situation with Hamas. The key part is what's going on behind the scenes with negotiations with Hamas and how Hamas will react. So the IDF can put in a cordon around there to allow the U.S. engineers to come in there and put the pier in place and open it up for logistics flow. That's the easy part. But now when you talk about in the middle of a conflict zone in a city, the risk can be rockets, mortars, small arms fire. So even just mortars fired from and rockets from southern part of Gaza put that U.S. force at risk. And you could just see a rocket or something hitting the pier while it's being put together. I mean, it could really dampen and really put a lot of pressure on the U.S. and what a failure the mission could be. So these negotiations, I think, are the key thing, what's going on behind the scenes with the IDF, with Hamas, to open up that corridor, to allow this to be a kind of a peacekeeping type mission, to be able to come in there and be able to provide the aid without putting the force at risk. And that's going to be the delicate one, because that could change at a moment's notice. Hamas could react very differently than what's agreed to. And all of a sudden, you've got a very chaotic situation on the ground with casualties to U.S. international players. And Hamas just gets more and more publicity.
Well, and if I can jump in real quick, I think that that's one of the biggest risks is that PR risk. And I think it's not just the risk to U.S. forces. I think that we saw that disastrous airdrop of aid where over 100 people were killed. And so I think that that's also going to be one of those big, big risks. This is obviously that there needs to be humanitarian assistance going in. We know that. It's clear. But how they do it, if there are unintentional casualties or if there are risks to U.S. forces or risks to people getting the aid, or God forbid, a terrorist attack that attacks either the pier or people receiving aid, that's going to in turn kind of undermine the entire mission, because it's going to be very untenable for the United States to maintain that if you have those kind of PR black eyes. So I think that that's going to be a really big thing moving forward, whether that's the risk to, again, the recipients of aid or the U.S. forces. I think that's going to be something that to really look at.
Part of this that I think that I missed was, what's the U.S. role going to be? And the U.S. wants to be a leader in this area. We don't want to defer this to someone else. We obviously saw China get involved early on and then kind of back off in some of those negotiations. So I think by the U.S. showing that we're not just one-sided supporting only Hamas and Israel, to come out of this, we got to show that we're kind of an equal broker to also support the Palestinian people and what this may look like afterwards. This would be a step in that direction for the U.S. to start to take some lead. Those airdrops were part of it. This would be another piece to show, hey, they are key players in this to pull the other players, you know, whether it's Arab states, European countries, whoever may be players in this afterwards. But it starts to take more of an international role than just only supporting the IDF.
No, yes, sir. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, in shifting gears a little bit to talk about the Red Sea, we released a SITREP last week following the impact of a missile into a commercial vessel that ended up killing three sailors on that vessel. This was the first act that resulted in fatalities after, you know, call it almost 4 to 5 months of attacks that have been happening in the Red Sea following the start of the war in Gaza back in October. And the U.S. has taken a bigger role over the last few weeks in hitting targets of opportunity, anti-ship missiles, you know, many of them being mobile, and other actions they can take to start to degrade the capabilities of the Houthis. But sir, I'll pass over to you for this one as well. You know, in thinking about, you know, I know we talked about this on the last one, and this is a problem that's not going to go away anytime soon. The U.S. is doing, you know, likely many things in its power to slow the progression of the Houthi capabilities against commercial shipping and coalition forces in the region. But as we think about the next few weeks look like, because if they made it clear these attacks will not stop until the war in Gaza is over. And there's also some questions around, you know, that might not be when they stop either, but we can address that one as well separately. What else can the U.S. be doing now to further degrade the Houthis' capability and provide safety for the ships in the region?
Yes, I think, Brett, you know, a key piece of this is that strategy is what the U.S. is on. It's almost been like a, you know, reaction type strategy. They've increased our attacks against the Houthi rocket missile drone being launched. But it's almost like I've heard people call it a whack-a-mole type approach. It's not what I would call a strategic air campaign to really go after this. And when we increased the attacks in Syria and Iraq, we saw through what we think is Iranian influence to get the Shia-backed militias to kind of back off. That's not happening here with the Houthis. And I think a key part here with watching the Houthis is they're winning the propaganda campaign, just as Hamas is really winning the propaganda campaign or information campaign in Gaza. They're winning it here in many ways. And when I say this, they're not winning the international community towards their cause, but they're really increasing their renown around the region. Because just a little bit before, who would have really known who the Houthis were? You know, unless you were really following the war between, the Saudis and the war that was going on inside Yemen, the support from the Saudis, UAE, that sort of thing. You weren't watching this very closely. You wouldn't really know who these guys are. All of a sudden, they're all over the map and they're kind of setting the scene. So when this clash is over, they're going to come out as winners, in at least in the sense of they've put their mark in the ground and people now know who they are. So looking at the U.S. strategy with Operation Prosperity Guardian, you look at it now, we've had a ship sunk. We've had several ships destroyed. You mentioned three merchantmen killed. Three quarters of the international shipping now is going around the Cape of Good Hope, around Africa. Egypt is losing revenue going through the Red Sea. And the Houthis are saying, hey, we're going to keep this going on until Israel stops its operations in Gaza and there's a ceasefire. And do you believe them? That's one thing. But they're going to continue this on. And so as long as the Israeli operations go on, they're going to keep doing this. So how do we stop it? And the whack-a-mole approach is, it almost seems like with Iran supplying these weapons, whether it was into Gaza, whether it was in Hezbollah in Lebanon, or whether it's here with the Houthis, this has been going on for years, and they've got unknown quantity of weapons that are there. And I would say in some ways, the intelligence we've had on the Houthis has been very lacking on how much is there and what capabilities they have, where it's located, because otherwise we'd be going after this much harder. So I think at the end of the day, I think the U.S., we can continue to keep going down this path and where we're at right now. And if the status quo right now, where the shipping is all going around, or a lot of it, and you're going to see now that you know, they're now having some effects on the international shipping by targeting them and hitting them, and the U.S. not be able to stop that, or the international community not stopping that, then that's going to put into question, is the strategy working? And is the U.S. willing to continue with the strategy? And I would argue if it's not working, then they're going to have to look for to recast kind of the military strategy that they've got. And that would look at going after much more of a campaign approach of going after the Houthi-controlled ports. They're going after their firing positions now, but looking at infrastructure, roads, electricity, their refineries that support it, to really kind of put the hurt on them and really kind of make them back off the way some of the Shia militias have backed off in Syria and Iraq. I think that's the next step. It could include targeted soft raids that would put some boots on the ground, but we're very good at doing that if we need to do that. But to me, that would be the next step if the U.S. Central Command and the Biden administration wants to kind of change the calculus of what's going on. And I will say the U.S. Navy is very operating very effectively. We've seen the Chief of Naval Operations come forward and the commander of the U.S. Naval Central Command, very proud of the way those sailors are operating. But again, when you look at the cost calculus of firing SM-2s and SM-6 missiles against drones that are just, you know, 1/10 or 1/20 of the cost, or ballistic missiles, this is not something we want to be in for a long term, and we could be in it for a very long term.
Absolutely.
And if I can just, please, if I can hop on with that, I mean, so we pretty much, as the general said, we haven't achieved deterrence there. They are still doing what they're doing. They can keep doing what they're doing. If they slow down or don't slow down attacks, that's not because of something we have done. We, as the United States, we as the international community. And so having that capability has essentially created a blockade, a de facto blockade, because people are not willing to ship their goods through that region, or at least not rely solely upon that. And so with a very small capability, they've actually had this completely outsized result. And so the question is then, do we need to change that calculus, and how do we do so? And I think that's what General Walsh spoke to so well, is like that just, we have the options of soft raids, but that involves boots on the ground. We have all of these other options, but what is going to ultimately be sufficient as a deterrent? And whether that's deterring Iran and having them stop supplying these weapons, or whether or not that's going in some capacity against the Houthis, but whatever we're doing right now is not working. And so, and make no mistake, we've supplied Saudi Arabia with a lot of weapons that they have used against the Houthis. So I don't know what we really can do short of these kind of more involved operations. And so I think the question will be, what is the appetite for doing so? And what is the calculus? How important is this to the United States? I mean, clearly it's important to international shipping, but is, with however many ways we're being torn as a government and as a kind of military right now, what is small enough to be able to do without drawing attention from all of the other fires that are trying to be put out right now all at the same time?
Definitely. Pete, I'll pass it to you as we just think about the broader situation more macroeconomically in the region. You know, should these attacks continue and additional ships are sent around the Cape of Good Hope, how disruptive is that to shipping in the, you know, short to medium term going from here?
Yeah, so I think in terms of shipping, this is yet another nail, as people really are thinking about their business plans going forward, where they want to put factories, where people are taking shipping no longer for granted. It was kind of, you did your map of the world, here's where you're going to produce something, here's what your shipping costs are roughly. I think that calculus is changing, But I think really in this right now, everything I'm listening to is really the 800-pound gorilla in the room is Iranian oil sales. Iran is pumping out probably about 3.5 million barrels of oil per day, pretty much near their full production capacity. Most of that's going to China and India. But that availability of that oil is suppressing global oil prices, which I think no one in the U.S. really wants to see oil prices rise again. We saw that inflation problem. So to me, that seems to be the gist of a lot of this is, does something trigger a response eventually where we have to crack down on Iranian oil sales, either because we're cracking down on Iran or we're trying to crack down on their ability to fund the proxies? That to me is the big risk. It's not there in the market yet today. People aren't paying close enough attention, but everything I'm hearing today feels like we're on the slippery slope where that is the direction we might have to head, or we're going to have to sacrifice some level of national security to allow Iran to continue to sell oil.
Thank you, Peter. Absolutely. In switching gears a little bit to Russia and Ukraine, Russia has been gaining momentum in recent weeks, obviously with Ukraine aid stalling in the United States, but also coming from the EU as well, just the flow of weapons, supplies, ammunition, et cetera, especially artillery, anti-missile technology has been slowing over the last few weeks. They are looking at what is likely going to be in some form, effectively a Russian offensive into the springtime to gain more ground in the east. There is word of F-16s that could be arriving as early as July, but they will be in very limited numbers as the timing of training the Ukrainian pilots is taking a little bit longer than expected. So it could be only a handful or so, arriving this time, effectively in July or summer. General Walsh, your perspective around the next few months and what they look like in Ukraine, as aid continues to slow, what do we think Russia's thinking now? What do we think Zelensky's thinking right now with respect to where they are in this conflict?
Brett, I think it's interesting to step back to and look at how Russia's gotten to where they're at right now. I think it's interesting that when we saw the first, invasion occur and everybody was kind of shocked at how poorly and ineffectively the great Russian Red Army operated. Since then, what we've seen is they've learned a lot. We had been training the Ukrainian military since 2014 how to operate much more like we did, Western military, unlike they did with their very closely controlled command and control, like a former Soviet bloc military. And that happened over many years, and that happened with a lot of U.S. support with their operations and teaching them how to use more sophisticated weapons to operate in smaller distributed operations, have distributed command and control, to be able to operate with leaders that can make decisions on their own without having to get, answers from the generals or direction from the generals. And what we saw was the Russians were operating just in their colossal Soviet slow, methodical way. They've changed their operations a lot. They're operating, they've learned, they've watched what's going on. And I would say now they're operating much more like a Western military would operate than what they had in the past. So they've learned. They've now also put their military, their industry on a wartime footing. And they're able to figure out how to sell their oil, how to operate around sanctions, how to re-engine their industrial capacity. And now they're cranking out weapons like we didn't expect that they were going to be able to do on this short notice. So I think this is a key thing here now is this, we see the lack of support coming out of the U.S. Congress to be able to get the funding to them. The Europeans obviously stepped up when they supplied the $56 billion. So I think this is a good news thing that Europe is now taking more responsibility that, hey, let's fight this war in Ukraine rather than fight it in Eastern Europe. But now what we're seeing is the Russians are starting to feel like they've got the offensive. And a lot of it's they've got the offensive because they've got the weapons to back it. And they've got the manpower of a country that's much, much larger than Ukraine. And they can sustain this meat grinder of an approach that Putin's been putting them on, along with now their weapons capacity, in many cases, 10 times along that front, greater than what we're seeing with the Ukrainians can do. And in many cases, the Ukrainians are only able to fire in close defensive operations when in close proximity, they're not affecting the deep battle. They almost have to wait till the Russians are close to them to affect the close battle. So they're not deep battle shaping, which is allowing the Russians to get closer. And now we're starting to see them encircling some more of these villages in the slow progress. It's also putting a really morale problem on the Ukrainian military. There's an awakening here that this isn't looking good. And on the other side, we see Putin just kind of going, it's moving in my position now, the way it's going, that he's now willing to go in this for the long term. And now you get into negotiating settlements and things like that. Putin, who had probably been more willing to settle, I think he's going to kind of wait to see how this offensive goes before he's ready for any type of negotiation. So the key part here, and I turn it right over to Maria, who understands this stuff very well, is how can we get the U.S. resupply into the Ukrainians? Because that, to me, is key right now. It's been the key all along. And now with us not getting that to them, the morale on the Ukrainian side is starting to falter because of they're seeing the reality of the Russian offensive operations going on. And the Russians are now learning how to fight, just like the Ukrainians are, with better weapons.
Thanks, General Walsh. I mean, I want to highlight a couple different things on this. So the first off is if we get F-16s, Russia does a few things really well. Ukraine does a few things really well, and the U.S. does a few things really well. The U.S. Is very ethical in how we handle foreign military sales and foreign military funding. And so if we are supplying planes, those pilots will be trained. But again, that does mean that the numbers will be incredibly limited. And so that's just something that we have to keep in mind. So I think that people get very focused on, oh, well, if we give them HIMARS and then ATACMS and then F-16s, but the extent to which a military can use it is only the extent to which we can train and maintain those systems. So that's just to start off. I think that some of the key elements going on right now are Russia's having elections this week for the presidency. I mean, the outcome of that is not in question in any way, but we have seen a very strong effort to tamp down an opposition. A lot of organizations have been named foreign agents in the last week or two. And so I think that they're really trying to kind of maintain the status quo through this spring. I think that if Putin has some military victories to point to, I mean, I don't think people are really voting that substantially, but I think it is a kind of, a PR issue internally. But the Ukrainians have been very good initially at the beginning of the war. They were just absolutely incredible at the PR operations, at the information operations, and kind of getting the whole world behind them. But historically, we've seen a lot of success from Russia on that. And I think that they've been doing very, very well with that recently. We saw leaks coming out of the German government talking about the Taurus missiles. That was incredibly embarrassing to the German Ministry of Defense and German Prime Minister Scholz. And I think that they're trying to sow as much dissent and disagreement that as they can within the US government, within European governments, within the EU. And so I think that a big question now is going to be whether in the US we can get aid across kind of the incredibly unhappy house that we have right now and across partisan lines. And if, I mean, actually not even partisan, it's much more nuanced than that, because I think the center of both parties very much believes that we should be sending this aid. Majority leader, minority leader, both Schumer and McConnell have expressed their support for this. But I think that Russia's doing very well at sowing that dissent and sowing that discontent. And they've demonstrated that with that leak in Germany, which I know that the Germans reacted to kind of very strongly. But I think ultimately all of this comes down to how long can Ukraine hold on and how long can they dig in and can they kind of wait out this period? Because I think that right now with us in an election year, elections all around Europe, I think that it's a very, very crucial point. And I think that a lot of these issues are going to be more politically charged than maybe they would be more consensus driven in a non-election year. So I think if Ukraine is able to dig in, if they're able to conduct some more of these maybe attacks deeper into Russian territory, maybe that changes something. But like General Walsh said, they're just not shaping it. They don't have the weaponry. And that's kind of the final thing I wanted to get to is we just talked about Iran. We just talked about Iran shipping weapons. Iran's shipping weapons to Russia as well. And I think that we need to kind of always keep that in mind, is that these two governments are incredibly close to one another. And so when we are able to get that aid to Ukraine, we are able to get that aid, that's using up some of those Iranian munitions as well. And so really this needs to be kind of looked at more holistically, which I think is something that we're really failing to do, not on the military level, but on a kind of strategic national level, international level. We're really struggling with that, whereas Russia does not have that struggle. They're really kind of, it's a lot easier to play the spoiler, and they're doing that.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you, General. Peter, I'll pass over to you for any thoughts on Russia, Ukraine. I mean, I know we are a long way away at this point from a ceasefire, armistice, you know, what a rebuilding of Ukraine could look like. But as we make it through the spring and summer and the fall post-election, and let's say in a scenario in 2025, a ceasefire is reached, you know, terms TBD, but, you know, then the reconstruction of Ukraine begins. What are some of the things that we need to think about as we start bringing, you know, dollars to bear in Ukraine, you know, likely mostly from the EU? The United States will likely contribute here as well in some way, shape or form. But where do you see that going as we start to rebuild Ukrainian cities post-conflict?
Yeah, I think one thing we all have to be, I think, well aware of is that it's highly unlikely that Russia goes back to selling a lot to Europe. I think that link has been severed. They are happy to deal with India. They're happy to deal with China. I think those supply chains are existing. So I think any sense that we can kind of go back to the way it is or was, that's over. There'll be better trade. There'll be something clearly than what's going on now, but we're not going to revert back. I think Russia has found, quote unquote, better customers in China and in India who want their fossil fuels, who want their resources and tend to grow, don't care about a lot of the ESG issues maybe surrounding any of that. So that, I think, is going forward. So you're not going to get this immediate kind of bounce back to the way it was. And then separately, I remain convinced this is going to be both a huge opportunity for companies who can get involved in this rebuilding. And at the same time, it's going to be an inflation risk, particularly in Europe. And why I say that is we still have all these Russian frozen dollar reserves. And I'm quite confident that any sort of truce peace agreement will see Russia getting some of that back, but some of it being kept to effectively fund the rebuilding of Ukraine, right? You can call it war reparations, however you want to phrase it. Some of that money is going to be allocated to rebuilding Ukraine. And normally when we think about these rebuilding efforts, they take time and it's always, well, who's going to pay for it? I think right now you have this ready source of funds. So you're going to see aggressive spending. It's going to have to go into building the infrastructure of Ukraine, enticing people to come back, right? A lot of Ukrainians will, by that point, have been away for 3 years. How likely are they to come back, especially if the situation doesn't look good? So you have to, you know, make things nice. And Ukraine has suffered in terms of the production of agricultural products, minerals. Some of that will come back in line. But again, my understanding is there's been a lack of investment or underinvestment for these 3 years as the war is going on. So you're not going to crank up to pre-war levels without a lot of spending. So you're going to see real material demands. You're going to need concrete, steel, all those things. That's going to be very inflationary. And then I think you're going to see wage inflation in Europe, where the number of jobs created to, you know, rebuild Ukraine could be high. It's going to entice European workers into that area to try and rebuild this. So I think it'll be good. I also think as part of this, there's going to be huge opportunity for U.S. companies who can get in there and become part of that rebuilding effort, because it will be spending like something we haven't seen since the post-COVID days in the U.S.
And if I can jump in on that as well. So I think in a lot, there's going to be a bunch of things that we have to look at with that. I think Peter's right on the nose. I think aid accountability is going to be huge. And then I think the brain drain was a problem for Ukraine prior to 2014. Brain drain was a problem for Ukraine prior to the full-scale war. And so, yes, I think convincing people to come back is going to be huge. I know that there's discussions going on right now, particularly in the EU, about kind of those war reparations and using frozen Russian funds. There are at least two countries that I know of that are still really pushing back. One of the ones that I thought was more interesting is Germany. I believe they're worried about what war reparations mean for them, even a generation or two on. But if they can come to that consensus about using those frozen funds, I think that that will be incredibly instructive for other countries and deterrent for other countries in the future, because Russia does have hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars around the world that have been identified by the U.S. Treasury in the past. And so if there is this kind of consensus that this can be used for Ukraine's rebuilding, I think that that will go a very long way. I think that that'll be, again, though, that'll raise that issue of both inflation and of accountability, because we know that despite the advances the Ukrainian military has made in terms of procurement, despite the advances the Ukrainian government has made in terms of trying to weed out corruption procurement processes, there are still a lot of issues there. And I think that it's going to be a potentially very lucrative space for US companies, but I think it's going to have a lot of pitfalls because just there are issues that are systemic there right now, and the war has not made them better.
I think, Maria, it's a great point that it will act as a deterrent. At the same time, I do think it's going to continue to propel this desire for countries to, especially the autocratic resource-rich nations who don't necessarily agree with us, to do more and more business with China, more and more in yuan, potentially more and more in cryptocurrency, because they see this threat and they will want to diversify away from it. I'm not saying that we're not going to be the reserve currency of the world, but I do think you're going to see, you know, we've been calling it almost like the black web of currencies or the dark web of currencies, where those who do more nefarious type things are going to want to be in crypto. They're going to want to probably be aligned into China, who seems very unlikely to ever take such a step. So at least not for the reasons that we were taking it. So I think that further separation, right, this deglobalization continues, and almost every good action that we take does spur some consequences that pushes it away to some degree as well.
Absolutely.
Definitely. Thank you all. Shifting gears a little bit into the South China Sea. Last week, we saw an incident in the South China Sea where the Chinese Coast Guard had a minor collision with a Philippine vessel as well, which was effectively in the process of resupplying the second Thomas Shoal. There's been a lot of tension in that region, as we discussed in our last podcast and also around the world, you know, in January and in February, you know, with the election of Lai back in January, the incident a few weeks back with the two Chinese fishermen dying off Kimmen Island, and now the incident in the South China Sea with the Philippine Coast Guard and the Chinese Coast Guard. Yeah, General Walsh, as we look at where this is going, tension in the region is nothing new. That is a fact. But it's taking tacks which could be potentially dangerous and could, especially if it involves the Philippines, obviously could involve the United States as well with the security pact that we have. So, General, what are your thoughts on the incidents over the last couple of weeks and where we think tension in the region is going in the near term?
Yeah, great question, Brett. I think, you know, when we look back, you have to look at China and the Chinese Communist Party and Xi Jinping for who they are and their long-term strategy. When you looked at how their economy was kind of suffering and Xi came out to the APEC conference in San Francisco, and he said that he wanted stability in the region and he wanted to reduce tensions. What we see out of the Chinese Communist Party is they talk nice, but they play hardball. And we know long-term what they want in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. You know, the international courts took the nine dashed line to court where China claims all that land, all that maritime domain for their own. And the international courts weighed against them and in support of the Philippines in their claims. But what do we see? Them ratcheting this pressure up. We saw the Chinese Coast Guard ships and maritime militia, water cannons, trying to stop the resupply of the Philippine military on the Second Thomas Shoal. We see this increasing more and more. And so what we are seeing in the region is this more aggressive nature, whether it's around Taiwan, whether it's around South China Sea, whether it's Vietnam or the Philippines, they're going after these minerals that are down and below the sea. And that's what they're really, they want to control that. Just like they want to control rare earth minerals, they want to control this because a lot of resources down in that area. So they're very aggressive in their nature. And I think they're going to continue to push to see how much support the Philippines has from the U.S. in their international community. And I think the U.S. has been very clear of bringing international partners and alliances together in the region, but it doesn't seem to be backing off China at all. Even with their economy suffering the way it is, it doesn't seem to have them, you know, playing nice in the sandbox like Xi said he was going to do.
Well, thank you, sir. I'll pass over to Peter as well, who had a wonderful piece over the weekend, you know, in thinking about China and how we should be looking at them, you know, economically, strategically, over the next few years in particular. But Peter, I'll pass to you for some of your thoughts on just the general goings on in the South China Sea, but, you know, more broadly, macroeconomically focused on China as well.
No, I think China for us has been the big, you know, macro geostrategics, you know, for a long time. General Walsh, you know, I think go back, we were in 2018, we wrote about China being a strategic competitor. General Walsh had helped put that into the national policy. We were talking the other day about 2015 when China issued their China 2025 policy, where they laid out what they wanted to do. They kind of backed off of that, at least publicly, because I think it was resonating poorly within the U.S. But the reality is, I think China has some economic problems right now. Everyone's well aware of them. You've got an aging population, the real estate market's going down. I think they're going to have a lot of difficulty convincing U.S. companies or foreign companies to build in China. I think everyone's kind of trying to diversify away. So if you just take a step back and say, well, what would you do if you're planning around this? Well, I think you try and sell your brands globally. And, you know, we use the term China Inc., where, yes, U.S. companies and the U.S. government are largely aligned, but they're certainly not working hand in hand. Sometimes they're at loggerheads in terms of policy. China has the ability to really frame a policy around, you know, what they want to in terms of selling their products. We think that what they're going to do first is suppress sales of U.S. brands where they can domestically, because that's the easiest thing to do. You know, in some cases, I think they've been banning certain products by being used in the government agencies, et cetera. So you start there, then you reach out to all these autocratic, resource-rich nations, many of whom China has a trade deficit with, and you start trying to sell them their goods. And so I think you're seeing this. I think we're already seeing it impact some of our companies. And then, you know, you almost want to laugh. And I think, you know, people think, go back to the Super Bowl, and we had, I believe it was 4 or 5 commercials from Temu. I believe I'm pronouncing it properly. I think people kind of laugh, and what is this? And you look at the site, and everything seems dirt cheap. It's brands we've never heard of. But is that, again, another way for China to start selling these brands that over time they've developed or accumulated a certain amount of IP? They certainly have the industrial processes down because everyone ceded a lot of their industrial production to China. So they understand how to do these things. And I think that's the real big risk, is not just what's going on at the high tech level, but China increasingly wanting to sell their brands globally and competing for sales with our brands, first in China, but then in emerging markets, potentially even domestically. It's going to be a battle of price. And that's not something I think we are really good at competing on right now, is not price. So I think this is a longer term thing. People are starting to see it. And as you mentioned, we did a piece this weekend. I've received so many responses and people forwarding me things, whether it's in Wall Street Journal or others, all pointing at the same thing, that China is pretty obvious about what they're doing. It's a fairly natural progression for companies and countries to do. And yet we're kind of ignoring it, and the threat potentially to our sales and the growth of our companies.
Well, Peter, thank you. Thank you. Maria, any thoughts on China and where we go in the next few months with respect to tension, especially leading up to Lai's inauguration in May, which we'll obviously be keeping a very close eye on as well?
Well, not to kind of beat the same exact drum as with Russia, but we saw the Party Congress in China show a lot of support for Xi. And I think that we're seeing kind of this consolidation of power in both of those states. And so I think that anyone who's kind of hoping, as much as we may hope for any changes in those, I think that it's just showing that we're going to get more of the same. I think it's interesting because in terms of consumer goods, like, I'm a young mom. And so I have a lot of friends who want to, I know, buy things for their kids and so on. And you see a lot of those traditional fears about that made in China or maybe quality control not being the same start to melt away because these really low prices, they're so, so enticing. And as we see kind of the TikToks of the world really sharing again, that kind of the social aspect of it and also that information aspect of it. And I think that we need to not sell that short, that the information operations, whether they're nefarious, military related or not, they're all encompassing and they exist. And China's, again, very, very good at those things. And so as you can market those things more and more and more, I had to have a conversation with our nanny when she was buying my kids some items that were coming from like Temu. And I was like, hey, I don't want that in our house for kind of all sorts of reasons. But I think that people don't appreciate necessarily how pervasive it's become. She'd gotten them a lamp and you had to download a Chinese made app in order to control the lamp from your phone. And I was kind of very taken aback by that because obviously any app that you're downloading can then come with spyware, with all sorts of other potential risks. And those are things that we're kind of more cognizant of, given my professional background, my husband's professional background, but it's something that she did completely without a second thought. And so I think that, those are things that are going to be more and more and more ingrained. And once you have someone in that kind of ecosystem of apps and so on, it's much easier to then advertise other items to them and kind of pull them more into your kind of ecosystem of goods.
Absolutely. Thank you, Maria. One final point before we break today, I do want to discuss the unrest in Haiti and the current situation down there on the ground. This past weekend, the United States evacuated some non-essential personnel from the embassy, and it also reinforced the embassy with security. But with the prime minister, you know, from the outside looking in, you know, trying to find effectively additional support, but with, you know, a country, you know, largely controlled by gangs at this point, security situation is extremely dangerous on the ground. General, I want to pass over to you as to what your thoughts are on where we are right now, and, you know, what, if anything, the United States can do to be helpful, and what the international community can do to be helpful here in Haiti.
Yeah, I think the big hammer here is never leave your country, because that's when coups occur. So Prime Minister Henry leaving to go to Kenya to try to work with trying to negotiate with the security forces that the Kenyan forces were going to provide in U.S. backed. That's when things kind of really unraveled. I think the real challenge here is you saw that we sent our fleet anti-terrorism support teams in to support the U.S. Marines at the embassy. They evacuated non-essential personnel there, so we still got the embassy in place. So things haven't deteriorated to that level. I think the key thing to look at is, you know, if you look at the Biden administration right now, there's so many things going on. They've got diplomatically just their plates full, and the plates are spinning, and they don't want anything to drop. And I think to try to grab hold of Haiti right now with all that's going on across the globe, that's why I think they were turning to more of an international focus and saying, if the Kenyans can provide the security force, we'll provide assistance to them, intelligence support, logistics support. But the U.S., like you said before, Brett, like in 1994, we didn't want to go in and own this thing. So now it'll be very interesting to see how this all goes down, because this isn't obviously the highest priority for the U.S. with all the else that's going on in you know, in Indo-Pacific, in Ukraine, and certainly in Gaza. So it's going to be interesting to kind of watch on how this plays out. And I think the Kenyan security forces were ready to come in, but there were some court issues with that. So everything on that is on hold. So without the U.S. taking lead on that, I think it's more of a wait and see on how the Biden administration can really influence the international community to jump in and support it.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. And we will end on that topic, but we will keep you updated with respect to all geopolitical events and macro events going on around the world via our written product. So please be on the lookout for more updates from Academy Securities. General Maria Peter, thank you so much for your time today. Always appreciated. And to all of our listeners, thank you all for your support. Looking forward to speaking again on the next podcast.
Thank you to all the contributors to this conversation, and thank you to our listeners for giving us the time. Academy Securities is a service-disabled, veteran-owned investment bank with a social mission to mentor, hire, and train military veterans to develop careers in finance. If you have an interest in connecting with our Geopolitical Intelligence Group members directly, please email us at info@academysecurities.com. I'm your host, Andy Robinson, and I look forward to sharing with you again soon.